Welcome to Movie Muse. It's a show about movies, music, and random musings about life, the universe, and everything. Its home is moviemuse.net, and on there you can get reviews, articles, and general waffling about films, TV, games, music, and whatever else we feel inclined to share. So let's get started with Movie Muse Episode 1, Attack of the Bonds. Right then, Movie Muse has got a core of five, and we'll have people dropping in and out at different shows. So this time we've got four of the esteemed bunch together, huddled in the metaphorical projection room. So let's introduce everybody. I'm Gordon Sir Clive, director for tonight's show. Then we have continuity controller, Matt Witchfinder Cohen.
Hello there.
We have Chief Grip, Graham JD and Diet Mason.
Hi there, guys.
And last, it's our resident junior deputy part-time apprentice work experience runner, Foggy B. Burton.
Good evening.
So, the first bit we'll do in each of the shows is to talk about what we've been watching recently. So, let's go first to Gripper.
The film I watched most recently was World War Z. Because my girlfriend is a big zombie movie fan, we watched all the Resident Evil films together, which is pretty cool, really. And we've been held off watching World War Z for a while. I've had it on DVD for ages, but she's not a fan of watching films after she's read the book. And as you probably know, World War Z is based on a book. Max Brooks, I think, is the author, and the film is quite renowned for being very different from the book. The book is basically a story of a guy who goes around the globe collecting people's stories of how a zombie apocalypse, which I think has been largely eradicated, has affected life, politics, you know, people in general. And this guy goes around and he's sort of like, it's almost like for an article or something, he's interviewing people and seeing how, you know, the zombie apocalypse affected various people and how it's changed the world. So it's quite an interesting premise, and it's got a lot of flashbacks and everything of these people that he's interviewing and their experiences during the outbreak itself. But the film is actually set, you know, after the apocalypse has happened. And obviously they decided with the film, they had quite a troubled genesis from what I understand, and they changed the ending a couple of times, and they decided that this was not going to be the way to film it. What they thought people wanted to see, not unreasonably in my opinion, they wanted to see the zombie apocalypse actually happen. In real time. So what you get instead is you get Brad Pitt and his family sort of waking up in sort of like Dawn of the Dead style, and sort of like they're going about their life. The film goes at great pains to show you that they're just normal family and everything, and then all of a sudden they're driving downtown in Boston, I think, and all of a sudden these zombies start coming everywhere. There's like a few reports on the radio and TV about an outbreak of rabies and stuff like that. And next thing you know, obviously, it's the end of the world as we know it. And Brad Pitt is sent all around the globe, this time not to interview people, but to try and find a cure. The film was very different from the book. I've never read the book. My girlfriend kept saying little comments all throughout, like, oh, this bit's not in the film, not in the book, and oh, I don't remember this, and all this sort of thing. But to me, it was a fairly straightforward zombie film. Two notable things about it. First of all, they wanted to make it a PG-13 in the US, so there's no blood in it, which is pretty strange. And secondly, whilst the film overall I would say was enjoyable, it was a bit disappointing, despite the fact that the zombies are pretty incredible in it, because a bit like 28 Days Later, they're not the sort of shuffling type you get in Resident Evil, or in Resident Evil games anyway. They're like super powered humans. They're jumping around. They were compared in the reviews to ants, because of the way they have extra strength, relatively speaking, and they're just like piling on top of each other. But to me, when a zombie horde was moving in the film, it was more like a tidal wave. That's simply the effect they were creating. It was like a tidal wave of zombies chasing after these people in time. But ultimately, the film is a bit silly, and it's got a couple of really bad plot holes, in my opinion, especially towards the end. But it's enjoyable, really. You know, a zombie movie, you kind of get what you put into it, really. So we kind of enjoyed it, and it was, for an hour and a half, it was a nice bit of escapism. The only major criticism I would have is that, like a lot of American movies I found these days, I don't know if I'm getting old, but everyone really mumbles and it's difficult to understand what they're saying, and there's a lot of key points that you kind of miss, and in the end we had to put the subtitles on because we literally could not understand what half the cast was saying.
The worst for it is Matthew McConaughey. The film Interstellar, absolutely brilliant film, but for half of the film I've no idea what he said. You just get the general gist of what he's talking about, because he just does not speak clearly.
No.
I think he's a fantastic actor, but he just needs to enunciate. World War Z, I didn't realise it was PG, so it didn't have any blood in it. That actually seems a bit weird. But my whole problem with the film itself is just that it's a zombie film. It sounds like a really interesting story. If all of those people were just dying of a plague, that'd be a much, much better story for me, because I'd prefer films that are more based in reality. So zombies don't really cut it for me.
No.
Although I do like the old Romero stuff, but I think that's just classic cinema, so not necessarily because they're groundbreaking films. But yeah, World War Z, or World War Z, whichever, has never really been something that I've been dying to see. But now you've just said it's only 90 minutes as well. For some reason, I thought it was like a 2.5-hour epic. So if it is only 90 minutes, I might well just be able to find that time and give it a go.
It doesn't let up for it. I think it's 1 hour and 40 minutes, actually, but it doesn't let up for the entire length. So you're going to be entertained, but it's really put the brain in neutral, I think.
I thought it was all right. But it must be called World War Z, surely, because it's made in America, not yeah. World War Z. Yeah. And also, isn't it supposed to be like World War III, World War Z?
Good point, yeah.
Anyway.
Those clever Americans. Boggy, I assume you haven't seen the film.
I haven't. Not a massive fan of the zombies in games or films, to be honest. Not an area that I'm that interested in. But I must admit, I read a book recently called The Girl with All the Gifts by M.R. Carey, and that was a zombie book. It was quite interesting how they did it. It's not it's based in England, and what happens is that they start off in this army base, and this girl, you don't know what about her, why she's all tied up and why she has to be wheeled out and can't be allowed out of this chair and has to go to these lessons, and all the kids are tied down. Basically, cut long story short, there's been this plague. What it is, it's like that thing, you know, when you see that thing on the TV with ants, it's that thing when they get a fungus and the fungus grows inside them and then it suddenly sprouts out and kills them, and it all grows up and the spores come out and it goes on from ant colony to ant colony. But it was like that, but it affected humans and it turned them into these zombies that, when they were called hungries, and what it was, when they needed to feed, they smelled or heard something moving, another human that wasn't dead like them, they became animated and became strong and came fast, and then just attack people in droves and try to eat them and rip them to shreds, but didn't attack each other. So that's the nearest I've come to watching a zombie thing like World War Z, but I've not seen that. But it was an amazing, interesting book. It was quite thought-provoking, to be honest.
While we're on zombies, we might as well stick on that theme, and I'll just tell you about a game that I've been playing recently, which is The Walking Dead. I did see first couple of episodes of the TV series and lost interest quite quickly. I never had any desire to play the Telltale Games Walking Dead Adventures, but it was free on one of the, I think it was Xbox Live. So I gave it a go and absolutely loved it. Following the story of a man who's going to prison, the police car crashes and he escapes, the zombie apocalypse has happened, finds a little girl, has to look after her, and it's about the relationships between people trying to survive. But it's a really interesting way that they've done the story, because it's not a massive amount of action in it. There's not actually that much for you to do, but they've built the atmosphere of it so well. And the decisions you make in one part of the game a few episodes later are going to come back, and people remember what you've said, and that influences how they are to you. And I found it absolutely riveting.
Played the first episode of that Walking Dead, so I know what you're talking about. It is very good. I never played the follow-up ones just because I had to pay for them, but yeah, they were cool.
Yeah, well, if
you can't believe you don't like the TV show, though. Best thing on television, in my opinion.
If you're on PlayStation Plus, season 2 of the Walking Dead is free this month on PlayStation Plus. So I got the first one free on Xbox, and now I've got the second series free on PlayStation. And I've not played through the second one, but it's a very different story. It's different people that you're following. It's not a continuation as such, although the timeline is a continuation, I believe. Matt, what have you been watching recently?
I watched 3 films over the past weekend. The first of those was Life of Pi, which I had never seen before. That's not strictly true. I did see about 10 minutes of it over somebody's shoulder on an airliner coming back from America in 2013. And it was a bit where the tiger's in the boat with the guy, which is obviously what most of the film is. And I was actually captivated, even though I couldn't hear the dialogue, not that there was much of it, and all I could see was this guy sort of fighting off a tiger in a boat, and that stuck with me, and I did want to watch it. It finally came along on TV a few weeks ago, and I recorded it, and we watched it over the weekend, and it was pretty cool. It's a totally ridiculous story, and There's some bits where it almost goes like 2000, the end of 2001, where it's all like psychedelic, which is a bit drug influenced perhaps. But yeah, I really enjoyed it. It was cool. I also watched Star Trek Generations, which I've never watched before. About 2 years ago, on Black Friday, 2 years ago, I bought off Amazon the 10-disc DVD set of the original Star Trek movies, and I'm still working my way through them 2 years later, and Star Trek Generations was utter bollocks. It was shit. It was the most contrived way to get the captain, the original Enterprise captain and the Next Generation Enterprise captain into the same place with this weird Nexus thing. It was bollocks, basically.
I've got to disagree with you there, Matt, but I suppose my pedigree with Star Trek films isn't great when I actually like The Voyage Home. But I quite enjoyed Generations. I like the fact that there's no earthly good reason for throwing them all together. It's just some stupid story, but I really enjoyed it. It just felt like an episode of Stargate or something.
And the last film that I watched was Dumbo, which the missus wanted to watch. And I don't think I've ever seen it from beginning to end before. I've obviously seen the standout scenes, the crows singing When I See an Elephant Fly and the pink elephants on parade. But I don't think I've ever seen the whole thing before. And my overriding feeling about the film now, seeing the whole thing, is it's a 10-minute cartoon spread out over 60 minutes.
They're quite long-winded, those old cartoons.
Terrible. And there's some real bad, and you can kind of understand it for the time it came out, 1941, pretty bad mild racism in there as well. So, yeah, not a good thing by today's standards.
Okay, well, I have recently watched a few Jason Statham films. Quite a fan of Jason Statham as a good old English bad boy.
I'm going to put him in the same sort of character as Hugh Grant. He just plays the same character, plays himself in every film.
Yeah, I think that's quite right. there's a lot of actors who are quite good at that, though, and just being themselves in a different situation in every film. But the films that I've watched that were Fast and Furious 7 or Fast 7 or whatever they called it, which I know Paul Walker died during the making of it, and we're all supposed to shed a tear at the end with this tribute, but I've got to say, the film was not particularly good, and sticking that on the end just to try and make it justified is a bit of a low trick for me, so I would not particularly enamoured with the film or with their so-called tribute at the end. Jace was good in it, and I'm glad they didn't kill him off so we can come back for another one. But after that, I decided to see what else I could find of Jace's work. Obviously, I've seen Snatch and things like that. I thought I'd seen the Transporter films. Turns out I've never seen the first Transporter film. And I loved it. I thought it was great.
The first one's really good.
Completely stupid. His accent is awful, and he loses it at certain points in the film and goes back to English. But I thought the action in it was good. I thought the love interest was good. The copper was very much like Commissioner Gordon, a cynical kind of policeman. And so I really enjoyed virtually everything in that film. For a silly little action film, I thought it was fantastic. And I'm pretty sure I have watched the second one. But I'll watch that again, because that one's in Miami, isn't it? That one's they took it to America. But I think then the third one goes back to France or back to Europe. So I definitely don't think I've seen the third, but I'm going to watch through the others this week, because, I'm a fan of the Transporters.
The second one I don't remember being very good. The third one I think was a bit better than the second one. Don't know if anyone else remembers that
one.
I've only seen the first one.
The first one was really good. I agree with you. My favourite Jason Statham movie is Crank.
Oh, Crank's great.
What happens in Crank? Give us a bit of an overview.
He has to keep his heart rate up, otherwise he dies. So he's like doing really dangerous stunts all the time and everything to keep his heart rate up.
But it's like Speed, but without the coach.
Yeah, that's very apt, yeah.
Sandra Bullock would have kept his heart rate up. Kept mine up anyway. Well, heart rates we're talking about.
Sounds great. I'll definitely be checking that one out then.
Also, if you want another good Jason Statham film, one I watched fairly recently was Parker, which has also got Jennifer Lopez in.
Yeah, I have seen.
Right, yeah, I thought it was quite good.
I thought he's playing the guy out of Thunderbirds, but there we go.
Can I just make a point about one of Matt's films that he mentioned? He mentioned Star Trek Generations. I actually saw Star Trek Generations in the cinema, and it's the only film It's the only time I've ever been to cinema to watch a film, and a film, I mean, it's very common in America, but it's the only time I've ever been to a movie in England anyway, and at the end, everyone stands up and gives it a standing ovation, and it literally, everyone in the audience just got up and clapped for about 5 minutes, and I was sitting there and with my mate thinking, why is everyone clapping this? It's a film, no one's going to know, you know?
We went to Alaska about 5 years ago, and we went to this little cinema in Anchorage, which is a cinema slash pizzeria. So you have a pizza while you eat, while you watch the film. It's got this, they bring it, they've got like the row of seats, and then they've got a table in front of them and a row of seats like that all the way down. And the bar lady brings you drinks and all that kind of stuff. So great place to go anyway. And they were showing The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, the original version of it, the subtitle version. And we're watching that. I didn't know much about the film, but it gets to the particular scene where she abuses her previous tormentor and then tattoos rapist on his chest, and the whole audience just broke out into rapturous applause and cheering at that particularly grotesque scene. So yeah, they're very partisan over there.
I had the pleasure of going to watch Spectre last week, so I thought we could have a quick chat about Spectre for any of us who watched it, and then we'll get into the wider Bond franchise and see what we think of all that. So, has anybody else seen Spectre?
Nope.
I'm afraid not.
I saw it last night.
What a serendipitous coincidence, Simon. Why didn't you tell us what you thought of it?
Well, as two of the guys haven't seen it, I don't really want to obviously give away too much plot and what's going on, so I'll just try.
I can probably guess what the plot is. It's the same plot as any other James Bond film.
Yeah.
I'm going to play something heavy here. It's the first of the Daniel Craig films I've ever seen, so nothing against Daniel Craig. I thought he played Bond very well. I liked his Bond. It was believable. He was a bit serious. This one, I think, compared to what other people have said, he plays the... There's a little bit more comedy in it, a little bit more quips and one-liners. Not many, just a slight, not quite Roger Moore's levels, never can be. But it was, I was a bit disappointed, to be honest. It was Bond by numbers. It was like Bond on rails. It was just a typical set piece, quite a bit, set piece, quite a bit. And I didn't even think the set pieces were that spectacular. Not really, didn't make the most of it. I thought that some of the plot was just unbelievable, and some of the way he found things or he did stuff. You think, how the hell would you have known that as there? How could you just happen to go to that point and find the thing you want? And suddenly it was just, it wasn't very believable. And I just, no, I'm very disappointed in it, to be honest.
To be fair.
Out of ideas, to be honest, and I need to maybe think about changing it completely or just maybe stopping it. I don't know.
To be fair, Simon, I was expecting you to like it, and I was expecting to be the one who was being the sourpuss and saying, what a load of old shit. But actually, we both agreed, it's crap. I watched it, and for the first 20 minutes, it might as well have been a scene out of the Uncharted video games. It looked like a video game. It had the little bits that you can recognise from a video game. You know, the beautiful shots of pre-rendered background. Mm. The sniper section of the game where you've got to do a little bit of stealthy stuff and not get seen by the people in the building opposite. And then it even felt like there was a quick time event helicopter fight. It was absolutely pathetic, I thought, the opening to it. My problem is that films have grown up, and that film felt like an old James Bond film, but wanted to be a real film. It didn't want to be the caricature that the old Bond films were, with all that cheese and everything. So they built this big, beautiful world around it, but then just made an old Bond film. So there's bits in it, and every time you hear the traditional Bond score, you know that something silly's going to happen, because they do the normal James Bond music, and it just signposts you to every little cheesy bit that's going to happen. But one of the worst things in the film is just how old Daniel Craig looks and how young the love interest, who falls in love with him in 10 minutes. That was a bit pathetic, because I know Bond always has the girl. That always happens, and that's part of the whole thing. But it was just, he came across as a dirty old man. The one bit where he puts his hand on her hand, and he's got a wrinkled hand with lots of hair on it, and it looks like an old man's hand. His hand on his granddaughter. It just did not look right. It was a bit distasteful for me. I actually like Daniel Craig, and I think this isn't the worst Daniel Craig film, James Bond film. By far, that is Quantum of Solace, which is possibly the worst film of all time, after Pitch Perfect 2 and Jurassic Park 3. but it's slightly worse than Skyfall, which is a pretty overrated film. But Casino Royale started so well. I really enjoyed Casino Royale. Reached the depths of Quantum of Solace, raised it up with Skyfall, and then it's back down to slightly better than Quantum of Solace. I was so disappointed with the film. I really was.
It's a bit that you, when you said about the computer game at the start, that bit when he blows, he shoots in the building, somehow he manages to hit a gas pipe or something, half the building explodes, and then the building he's on starts to collapse, and that is literally like Drake. It's like Drake in the game. He's falling down, he slides down, he grabs onto a ledge, he stands on the ledge, and he has to jump down, and all the it was just like playing an Uncharted game or something.
That is exactly the bit that I'm talking about, where he slides down, and then the joke at the end where he lands sat on a sofa. It was just awful, really, really bad.
And I thought the helicopter thing after that was poor as well.
So now we've slagged the new shiny James Bond off. Why don't we talk about a little bit more about James Bond in its entirety?
Yeah.
Just before you do, Graham, how glad are you we haven't paid any money to go and see that?
Well, the only thing I'm a bit disappointed about is obviously this is the return of Spectre. Obviously I haven't seen it, but I presume from the title of the film that Spectre, Special Operations, Terrorism, whatever they're called, extortion are in it. And they haven't featured in a Bond film since Diamonds of Forever in 1971 because of the argument with that Kevin McClory bloke. So it does sound a bit disappointing, that
I don't think
the return of Spectre has been not great.
I think that there are a couple of things they did well. There's a henchman for a start. There's not been a proper henchman in a Bond film for a long time, and I've no idea what this guy's called, but he was good. And I was disappointed when I think they killed him. I can't remember whether they did or not.
On the train, when he had the rope around his neck and
so
he vanished.
I thought they got that right. Get a good henchman in, and you knew everywhere where he turned, that guy was going to be there, and it was good. But Blofeld himself was a bit of a nothing character. Compare him to the bad guy in Skyfall, another one I can't remember the name of. I thought he was brilliant as a bad guy in Skyfall, and then Blofeld just didn't do anything for me. He just didn't seem sinister enough, or I don't know, I just couldn't believe in him as much as I believed in the Skyfall bad guy.
The earlier Blofelds, to be honest. No.
Was Blofeld
had a white cat, though.
Yeah, he did have
a white cat. Well, okay, at least they got something right. Don't you think it's a bit strange that this big group of sort of terrorists and stuff have got like an acronym for what they do?
Let's stop the Spectre bashing and let's maybe get onto something about what we do like about the Bond film.
The thing that I always remember is Sean Connery with the Aston Martin DB5, the very first Aston with all the optics, the bulletproof shield at the back, the changing number plates so you can go to different countries, the guns in the lights, the spinners come out the wheel with those typical sort of spoky MG-type wheels, and it comes out and punches the tyres of the other car. It's just that car sums up Bond and everything. That's just fantastic.
Yeah.
I do like Timothy. Timothy Dalton had a few with his Land Rover and a bit with the skis. I had just loads of the car bits. It's always about cars. I always like his vehicles.
For me, the car has got to be the Lotus, though.
I like the Renault 11. The Renault 11 in A View to a Kill is fantastic, and he leaves a little bit of it left. I do like the Aston in the one with The World Is Not Enough, and that was when The World Is Not Enough when it had the one that went invisible. But I like the Aston.
Wasn't that a BMW?
But I like it when he goes, John Cleese goes, Aston Martin, call it the Vanquish, we call it the Vanish. I just like that bit.
That film is the pits. That is the worst Bond film of all time.
And it's got Denise Richards in it.
No, that was The World Is Not Enough. That was okay. It was Die Another Day was the invisible car one.
That was terrible.
He's always panicked and stuff. Yeah.
That was the pits. Not even Halle Berry in a bikini could save that film.
My favourite Bourne car is the BMW from Tomorrow Never Dies, because it has that, I think it's a brilliant scene, where basically he jumps into the car. He's in like a multi-storey car park. Oh, he jumps into the back seat of the car, and the clip on YouTube is called Backseat Driver, because basically he's in the back of the car. He's got an old style mobile phone, which he opens up, and it's got like a mini steering wheel in it. Not actually a steering wheel, but it's like a little pad that you can steer it with. So he's basically driving, trying to escape this car park, being attacked by all these, you know, henchmen. God knows what else. And there's just one really cool moment in it, which is, I don't know, maybe sums up me more than the movie, but he's being chased by the bad guys, and he's got these spikes that come out the back of the BMW. I think they're like caltrops, they're like these things, and hundreds of them come out the back of his car. And the car behind him obviously runs over them, and all the tyres go flat straight away. And James Bond carries on driving, but he gets to the point, and like, they lower the shutters, and he shoots them with his rockets. You know, all standard crap, but James Bond cars have rockets and shit, and they don't move or anything. So he spins around, and he goes back the same way, and obviously he's got to run over these spikes again. So he runs over these spikes, all the tyres on James Bond's cars go flat, and Pierce Brosnan is sitting in the back of his, or lying in the back of his, presses his button, and his tyres just suddenly reinflate. You know, he's like got reinflated the tyres, and Pierce Brosnan gives this little grin, you know, as if to say, like, I've got rocket launchers and shit like that, but you know, this amuses me, you know, that the fact that I can reinflate my tyres. And then he's got this phone. It's like there's this German, or maybe it's the car, but it's giving instructions all the time, and it's saying, like, you know, you're risking your warranty and all this sort of shit as he's driving around getting shot at and everything. And then finally he drives it all the way up to the top. He's in Hamburg, is where they filmed it. It's where the film set this part. And he jumps out of the car, all the bad guys still chasing after it, thinking he's in it. And he puts it straight over the roof of the car park and into the busy street below. You know, James Bond doesn't care if anyone innocents die or anything like that, obviously. And it crashes straight into an Avis rent-a-car shop. And this voice in the background says, "Thank you for a safe journey," something like that. And that's the end of that clip, and that's the end of the BMW. But that was my all-time favourite gadget of James Bond. So I think that scene is just great.
One thing I've never understood about Bond: surely in the criminal fraternity, his name has got out now. So.
Well, everyone knows him, don't they? Everyone knows him. It's ridiculous. He's the most well-known super agent ever.
And he always says Bond, James Bond. Surely, as soon as that's hurt, there's 15 machine guns on him. It's just ridiculous that it would give his...
Well, in A View to a Kill, which was filmed in 1985, so obviously it's pre-internet days, the evil villain, James Bond is visiting the evil villain. He sits down in front of the evil villain. The evil villain's got a computer. It's Max Zorin. And he's typing on his computer, and he's obviously got connection to some intranet or something like that. And he's typing on his computer, and he finds out who he is straight away. So he's sitting there, and then James Bond has turned up and said, "I'm David, Sir David Smith," or something like that.
Stock,
and
he's called
straight away.
Robert Stock from Horse and Hound magazine or something.
That's it. Yeah, and straight away, this guy types in on his computer, and bang! Oh, it's James Bond, super villain. You know, just shoot him, end of film. That's it, isn't it?
Exactly. I mean, that's one of the things that I have actually put a review of Spectre on the Movie Muse website. And in there, I do mention that one of the really annoying bits is where Blofeld's got the opportunity to kill Bond, but does the 1960s Batman and tells him what's going on and allows him to escape instead of just putting the bullet through his head or, at that point, needle through his neck. But he just gives him the opportunity to escape. And I know that it's a film and you've got to build up the tension and he's not going to die, but it just seemed a little bit too easy. The script was just not up to it at all.
They always justify it by saying that it's the bad guys, they're megalomaniacs, and they've got to explain away what they're doing because it's part of their ego. But like you say, if you really wanted your plan to succeed, you know, bullet to the head, job done, move
absolutely
on.
Absolutely. Another thing that I've got a bee in my bonnet about, Bond songs. What do we think of the best and worst Bond songs?
The latest one is the worst, definitely.
Shocking.
Is that a unanimous vote?
Yeah, well, I haven't really, I've heard it a bit on the radio, but I don't like that guy anyway, that Sam Smith guy, so I'm not going to like his Bond song.
He basically saw Adele's Skyfall and thought, I can write another one of them, and tried to copy it and did a really bad job of it. It's awful. So what about good Bond songs? Ripper.
I don't think you can beat the Shirley Bassey ones, basically, the themes that she sung. Obviously, Goldfinger was kind of the great one. I think she did Moonraker as well. And a third one, I believe,
Diamonds
I can't remember.
Diamonds Are Forever.
Yeah, I mean, they're all great songs. And also, the one I have a bit of a soft spot for is You Know My Name by Chris Cornell Casino Royale. I'm quite a fan of that as well. I know that got a lot. That got a lot of stick when it first came out, akin to this Sam Smith song, but I really like that song.
Simon?
It's going to be a bit of favouritism, but Duran Duran, obviously Duty Kills, and I really like, so I like the video. I like Duran Duran, so I'm going to like that. I didn't mind Aha, Live in Daylight. It's catchy enough at the time. It was big in the 80s, 87 it came out, so that was a big one. So I'm quite like most of the Bond theme. I can't think of, I'm not so keen on most of the more recent ones. Sheryl Crow, not interested. I like the White Stripes and I know that, but I thought Jack White's run with What's Her Name was absolutely atrocious.
That is probably the second worst for me.
This Sam Smith one's rubbish. I didn't like the Skyfall, wasn't keen on that either. I don't like any of the more recent ones. I don't know Chris Cornell. I like Audioslave and stuff, so I have not heard that track, so I can't comment. But I didn't mind a lot of the early ones, Carly Simon, things like that. It's all just part of the Bond, what you grow up with. You remember the song from the film. I like The Spy Loved Me, so I like the Carly Simon one. I like most of them, to be honest.
Okay.
No, particularly of the earlier days, I like most of them.
It was rumoured, I don't know if it was actually true or not, but I'm sure I read it somewhere, that Morton Harkett was offered a part in, was it The Living Daylights they did?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah, he was offered a role as a minor villain in The Living Daylights, but he turned it down because he thought they were casting him because he was famous rather than his acting abilities, which is probably true.
Didn't know that.
Yeah.
Okay, which is?
You Know My Name by Chris Cornell. I'm a big Soundgarden Chris Cornell fan anyway. I love his voice. I think he's one of my favourite singers. But I just think the thing I like about it is, even if you didn't know it was associated with a Bond film, you know it's the Bond film song because it's got that like dun 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 at the beginning of it. Sounds like James Bond, but it's got his voice. You know, it's his song, but it's also a Bond song. And for that reason, the garbage one that was done for The World Is Not Enough is a similar sort of thing where it's garbage, but you know straight away it sounds like a Bond theme. And going further back, it probably Nobody Does It Better, which was Carly Simon, was it, from The Spy Who Loved Me, is a good one from the older era.
I think all
and Live and Let Die.
I think all of mine have been mentioned now. I was just going to mention Live and Let Die, and that was the only one that's not been picked up. But I think the Shirley Bassey ones are just iconic Bond songs. I actually quite liked Skyfall. I'm not a fan of Adele, but I thought that fit with Bond opening. But for me, the best of, apart from the Shirley Bassey ones, the best are definitely the 80s ones, the Aha, Duran Duran, Paul McCartney. They're the ones that scream Bond to me.
There's one I do like, which no one really gets inside. I'm not a fan of Lulu's, but I like The Man with the Golden Gun. It's quite catchy. It's very 70s, but even Thunderball and things like Tom Jones, that wasn't that bad. Matt Munro and all that old stuff isn't that bad.
Matt Munro, much of the love.
I thought Tina Turner, Goldeneye, obviously it's just a clone of the Shirley Bassey ones, but that was quite good as well, in that it was a clone of the Shirley Bassey ones.
Okay, quick question, quick answers. Favourite Bond? Boggy.
Timothy Dalton for me.
Graham.
Sean Connery.
Roger Moore.
And Sean Connery for me too. So there you go. That's pretty much Bond done, except we've not touched on the future. There's every day you're hearing that this person's going to be the next Bond. Is it going to be a black man? Is it going to be a woman? Is it going to be... And I almost said Craig Charles, but I don't think it's going to be Craig Charles. Is it going to be Daniel Craig again? Who do you think it's going to be? Who do you want it to be? We'll start with you, Graham.
Is it Idris Elba?
Who's that?
the guy that they're talking about a lot. I think he'd be great, to be honest. I don't see any reason why it shouldn't be a black man. Of course it shouldn't. There's no reason why it shouldn't be a black man. There's no reason why it shouldn't be a woman, really. Whether they'll go with a woman, I don't think they will, because I think they'll just think that that's sending the series in a completely different direction. I mean, I did jokingly suggest earlier Scarlett Johansson. So obviously she played Black Widow in the Avengers films, so that's kind of a Bond-esque role, because she can like turn herself invisible, and she's got a lot of spy sort of talents in those films, so she would be an obvious choice for me. But of course then you'd end up with a film that's more like Lucy or something like that, which is not really a Bond film, so I doubt very much they'd go for a woman. But I think Idris Elba would be perfect, or would be great in the role. He's a great actor.
Boggy?
Not something I've ever thought about. Idris Elba is always the one that I agree with Graham. I think he would be a good Bond. I'm not known much for acting. I haven't seen much that he's in, but his Sky adverts he looks very good in. So I think all those years we've had over the years of talking about people with Bonds and actors being associated with them. I remember one guy who's he's not been a massive actor over the last few years. Remember Clive Owen? And it was almost before Brosnan, it was going to be him.
Children of Many.
It was very good. Families. Mm. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
And I just thought, yeah, someone like him. But Pierce Brosnan I thought was all right as a Bond. I didn't think he was that bad. But I've honestly, no, I've got no real thought. I think Idris Elba would be fine. I can't see any reason. I don't think it would be a girl. I wouldn't be anything wrong with that, but I can't see them going that far. They did it in Ghostbusters, and that's just killed it for me on that one already. So,
do you know the last time there was a big fuss about the next Bond? Well, usually there's a big fuss, but after George Lazenby was in on A Majesty's Secret Service, it didn't do very well, the film, in America, and he was offered the role apparently again, but he turned it down. But they had a real big trouble getting the next Bond, and apparently their first guy that they were going to go to was Burt Reynolds, but he turned it down. And the next guy they went to, or the next famous, relatively famous guy they went to, was Adam West. And I just can't imagine Adam West being Bond. And they were in such trouble trying to find the next Bond. They didn't know who to go to, who to turn to, that they went back to Sean Connery and basically just offered him a shitload of money. He got like over $1 million for Diamonds Are Forever, which in 1970 was a huge amount of money. So they ended up going with Sean Connery again, and then obviously that was the last one he did. And
amazing to think how the franchise could have turned out if they'd have gone with Burt Reynolds or Adam West. But that's completely not the James Bond that Ian Fleming wrote, or the James Bond that we love today, or we tolerate today. Matthew, what's your thoughts
on that? Well, I was going to talk about Idris Elba as well, because, I don't know, I mean, you can look at it in two ways. I mean, James Bond is a character, and it's supposed to be the same guy all along, isn't it? It's not supposed to be like Doctor Who, where it's the same different people with this taking on the same name. So should a black guy play James Bond? But then on the other hand, why shouldn't a black guy play James Bond? Because it's obviously not the same guy anyway. So other alternatives, I have no idea. I think a woman's probably taking it too far away from what it was supposed to be, but who knows?
I've got to say, we're being surprisingly uncontroversial here, because I also think Idris Elba would be brilliant at it. But I actually was thinking of a different person who coincidentally is black. It's not because I was looking for a strong black man who I think could play the role. And it's David Oyelowo, is that how you say it? The guy who played Martin Luther King in Selma. He was an absolutely fantastic actor in Selma, and how he didn't get nominated for one of the big awards, I've no idea. He was absolutely brilliant, and I've seen him in a few other things, and he would be great, and I'd probably choose him over Idris Elba. But wow. I'm with you guys as well. I don't think that James Bond can be a woman. I think that's a different film, and there's no reason why they shouldn't make that film. I just don't think that's James Bond. For a start, how many women do you know called James? You know, I just don't see that you can do. You can't flip the gender of a character and say it's the same character. You can change the skin colour, because the skin colour doesn't make any difference at all. But changing the gender actually does, because we are different people.
They changed the gender of M, didn't they?
Yeah.
So, not the main character, is it?
It's not.
M's just a civil servant who's probably just been promoted. It's just a different person playing that role in the civil service.
Exactly.
In MI6. It's not the same character.
You could still call it 007, couldn't you?
I actually go back to what one of you said, and I can't remember which. I think it was Matt who said that it's supposed to be the same person. Has that ever been definitively agreed? Because I don't believe that. My view is it's that James Bond is a code name for that role.
They're all different eight people filling in that role.
That's the question, really, isn't it? I mean, I think when Ian Fleming wrote it, it was always the same person. Was it? Would you not say?
Yeah.
And I think
it's the same person played by different actors.
About one person,
So I don't know.
Do they actually follow the books anymore, though? I mean, I don't know. They've run out of books
to follow, haven't they? That's the only other question is, would a remake of an earlier Bond story be viable?
Yeah, they should do Thunderball again.
So next up, we've got the Movie Muse Film Club, which is a chance for listeners to get involved. So each week, each show, we'll announce a film that we're all going to watch over the next period before the next show, when we'll give our expert cultured opinions on what we thought, or excuses for not watching it in Simon's case. Then we'll give the film a score, we'll aggregate all of our scores, and then we can build up a league table of the Movie Muse most recommended. First to pick a film, it's Mr. Witchfinder. So, Matt, which Nicolas Cage film are you going to force on us this week?
Yeah, there seems to be some rumours out there that I'm a big fan of Nicolas Cage, which is not why I put the Nicolas Cage film of the week up on Facebook. The Nicolas Cage thing is purely that on any given week, you can watch a Nicolas Cage film. There's always a Nicolas Cage film on the television every week without fail. It's not that I like him. Anyway, moving on. The film I've chosen is a fairly obscure film called Star Crash, and it's available on DVD. It stars Carolyn Munro, who was a Bond girl, also David Hasselhoff and Christopher Plummer. It was made in Italy, and most, as I understand it, I've not seen it myself, it's basically a rip-off of Star Wars, made in the early 80s, I think, and most of the cast was recorded in Italian, the language was Italian, and then they were dubbed into English. So, as I understand it, it's pretty awful, but something that I've actually had on DVD for about 4 years and never watched, so it's about time I watched it, and why not bring you into that pain at the same time?
It sounds awesome, I've got to say. It sounds absolutely brilliant. So I'm going to look forward to that. So what we'll do is we'll stick some up on Facebook and see if our listener or our single Facebook follower decides to watch it with us. And then we'll have a chat about that next time. Let's move on to what we're looking forward to in the future. So, Boggy, for this show, we thought we'd let you choose a trailer for an upcoming film that you think is going to be pretty good, one that we should be checking out. So, what was your choice?
Well, when I went to see Spectre last night, my most enjoyable part of the whole evening was the trailers. there was a few on there, and one that stood out to me, looked quite interesting, was called The Revenant, which is a apparently a biographical Western thriller. Stars Leonardo DiCaprio and Tom Hardy are its main stars. And it's quite, even the trailer I thought was quite violent and quite a lot going on. It looks a little bit scary. I've just had a quick look at what it's about, and I've just, from what I got from the trailer, it's about he's a fur trapper based in the year 1823. He's brutally attacked and mauled by a bear. You see that little bit of that in the trailer. You see him getting the bear coming at him and taking him out. His colleagues he's with, he's obviously just with a band of them, and obviously in those days it was lawless. There was no sort of police around, so it was his companions think he's dying. He's on his way out, or he's dead. They rob him and leave him to die. They try and bury him, but he isn't. And he manages to get away, and they kill his Native American son to sort of cover up the tracks. And then the whole thing is him setting out on a mission to try and find them, seek them out, and as they betrayed him, and exact revenge on them. That's what I've got just from the synopsis and just a little bit from the trailer. Comes out on Christmas Day. So it's one I might actually make an effort to go and see.
We've all had a watch of the trailer to see what we think. So, Matt, what's your thoughts?
It's interesting. Probably won't go and see it. Wait for it to come out on some kind of home viewing thing. But, yeah, it looked all right. Pretty brutal, as you were saying. Leonardo DiCaprio looked pretty rough. Not his best, most handsomest role. But, yeah, could be. There's quite a few Westerns potentially coming out, which is unusual these days, with what's-his-face, Tarantino doing another one. Yeah, so maybe the Western's going to get a bit of a resurgence next year.
I think that link back to Tarantino, that's what I thought when I watched it, is that this is somebody looking to make a Tarantino-esque film. I didn't like the trailer, I'll say that. One of the things that I disliked most about the trailer was when it said a film by Alejandro González Iñárritu, just because he's the guy who I think he co-wrote and directed Birdman, which won lots of Oscars and was just dreadful. I'm really at a loss to understand why it was so lauded over. And that's what worries me about this film, is I actually like the sound of the story. I liked some of the visuals of the trailer, but not the heavy breathing and slowed down. And there's a fine line in the trailer, and you can go for show too much of the film and ruin it, or just drag it out into boredom. And I think I felt like that's what they did in this trailer. So I wasn't keen on the cutting of the trailer, and if that's the same person who's going to cut the film, then maybe it's not a good sign. But I love the idea of it, and I love how brutal it was. That's what excites me, because I do like brutal films, and I'm hoping that it can be a Tarantino-esque film in that it's brutal, but without being overly quirky for the sake of being quirky, like a lot of recent Tarantino films.
Have any of you guys heard of a film called Ravenous?
Yes, Guy Pearce.
That's right, and Robert Carlyle. It's set in the Old West, or not necessarily the Old West, but the New Frontier in the late 19th century, and it's basically a film about cannibalism, about how if you eat the flesh of another person, you gain their strength. So, but it's set in a snowbound northern frontier, sort of like a US Army outpost. And when I first started watching this trailer, I just thought to myself, this looks just like Ravenous, because it's like a wild setting. It's obviously set at the same, roughly the same time period. And I love Ravenous, and this kind of piqued my interest because I started watching the trailer and I thought, well, this looks pretty cool. But I'm with Gordon on this. The trailer basically tells you nothing about the movie. Simon's just given me a load of plot details, and I don't remember seeing any reference to any of that in the trailer. You wouldn't know that. So all I know about the film really is that it's set in the Wild West, or in that sort of time period, in somewhere presumably in the north or the winter. And, you know, Tom Hardy's in it and Leonardo DiCaprio's in it, and there's something going on. Some people are unhappy with them. I mean, all this is fine. There's no problem with any of that. But I always worry when a trailer doesn't tell you anything, because I think that means they haven't got much to tell. And if it's basically a simple revenge story about Leonardo DiCaprio, someone, you know, betraying him or something, he goes on this massive journey, finds himself, and then finds all the other guys and kills them, and that's the end of the film, that would be a massive disappointment to me to go and watch a film like that, because basically you should be making more of a movie than that.
One thing I would say is that I'm quite happy that Leonardo DiCaprio is doing the role. I think he's become one of the... there are a big group of actors who are so highly paid and highly thought of in box office terms that you don't often feel like they need to try. And the last Mission Impossible film, I think, was an example of that. Tom Cruise looked old, didn't really look like he was trying that much. And
found it in, yeah.
DiCaprio, I think it books that trend. He's as big as they are. He's as big a box office draw as they are. He's actually proven he's a good actor. And then the roles that he's been picking recently have been fantastic. And there was a time when I was hoping Johnny Depp was going that way, and then he decided to do a lot of... Well,
Pirates of the Caribbean.
Possibly Pirates of the Caribbean. Maybe Pirates of the Caribbean 2, 3 and 4. I think the first one was absolutely great to build that character.
Pretty good.
But probably more things like
Lone Ranger.
Where it's blockbuster films of big franchises, and they don't need him in it, and he doesn't need that. I just don't think he's used his talent particularly well, although there's a great new film coming out very soon. Is it called Black Something or Other? Where he's a gangland boss, I believe. I saw a trailer for that the other day. And
that was the trailer of that last night as well.
Is it Black Mass?
It's something called. Like, yes.
But that looks brilliant, and I think that might be a return to form for Johnny Depp. But I think of these massive actors, you know, your George Clooney's, your Johnny Depp's, your Brad Pitt's, your Leonardo DiCaprio's. Leonardo is standing head and shoulders above them in terms of picking good roles and playing them so well. Who would have thought, maybe you would, but who would have thought he would play that role in The Wolf of Wall Street as well as he did? You know, he was a clean-cut kid, and he played this horrible person, in parts of the film, it's a horrible person, so well and so believably. I think he's turning out to be one of the best blockbuster actors that are out there. So that gives me hope that... I don't recall a recent film that he's chosen that's been a bad film. Why don't we move on to the movie score of the show? Music's obviously a massive part of films. So each show we're going to pick on a specific score and try and end with a song. So Graham, we've given you the honour of picking the score for this week. This isn't picking a single song. This is trying to find a movie that's got a score that is particularly, particularly good or evokes particular emotions or whatever, and we'll stick one of the at least one of the tracks on at the end of the podcast, and hopefully people will agree. So, what have you picked for us this time, and why?
I've picked Aliens, which is obviously the sequel to massive hit Alien. And I picked it basically for a couple of reasons. First of all, obviously, I think it's a great soundtrack. Second of all, it's by James Horner, who sadly passed away earlier this year. And yeah, I think I count it as one of his best works. Put it that way.
I can't say I'm okay. I can think about the score from Aliens. Alien itself is probably easier to get that kind of claustrophobic sound in your head, but I don't really recall that. So I'll look forward to listening to a few bits.
Well, I think the key thing, as far as I'm concerned anyway, others might disagree, but the key thing for me with a film score is you don't really notice it when you're watching the film. You know, it's there to accentuate the action, really, or what's happening on the screen, and to kind of make that feel more poignant or whatever. So if kind of you're listening to the score and worrying about the music rather than what's on the screen, that's not really doing its job, in my opinion. And then you buy the CD of the score, like I do, I buy lots of film scores, and you listen to it in your car, and then as you're listening to your car, you think back to the movie, and the movie's playing in your mind. And I think Aliens is one of those scores. I mean, the original, it's funny you should mention Alien. I presume most of you guys have seen these two films. Alien was really a horror movie, wasn't it? Let's be honest. You know, it was like a horror ghost house movie, wasn't it? It was one guy, or rather an alien, running around killing off people one by one. It's a classic horror movie setup. And the music reflects that by Jerry Goldsmith. It's very downbeat. There's not really a great deal of action music, apart from the odd, you know, where you get the high-pitched sudden noises to show when the alien's about to attack, or whenever there's a shock, or whenever the fucking cat jumps out or something, you know. But then when they did Aliens, obviously that was more of an action sci-fi movie than Alien. So what they obviously decided was, you know, to change composer and bring in James Horner. Up at that point, James Horner was probably best known for Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, which is another great soundtrack. But for this, he had to compose something a little bit more varied, because at the start of the film, I don't know if you remember at the start of the film, but you've got Ripley's asleep in the escape capsule from the Stromo, and she's just drifting through space. She's discovered by the salvage guys, and then she goes to the hospital in the space, whatever, and it's very slow, the start of it. If you watch the special edition, there's the bit where they discover, they go back to LV-426, the alien planet, and there's like colonists there and everything, and they discover the alien. And the music's all very slow, and it's very reminiscent of the first film. So that carries on. And then you get the what I call the sort of military-style music, which Horner introduces, which is all very stark drum beats, trumpets, anything military-related, even some metallic-sounding sounds. God knows how they made them. They don't sound as if they're made with instruments. And whenever the Marines are there, it's like, you know, parade-type music, and like they're all standing to attention and everything, and it's like, yahoo, we're going to bust these alien Xenos and that sort of shit, and America going to war and all that crap. And then in the third and final act, you get the more dramatic music, as basically everything goes to pot, and they realise that they're up against something that they're not going to beat easily. And then you kind of get the dramatic music, Ripley taking over, you know, she's the boss all of a sudden, and you get the grandstanding themes that maybe James Horner's a bit more associated with. Though actually, over the entire film, for him anyway, because he's been quite criticised over the years for copying his own work as well as others, or imitating, I suppose you'd say, actually the film's got quite a varied soundtrack, and I think that's probably why it's one of my favourites.
I'm like you in that I do like a good film score, and I do like to listen to them away from the film. There's a massive difference between a film soundtrack and a film score. And sometimes it doesn't work as a standalone, because sometimes you've got, you know, small scenes that have tiny little bits of music that just break up the flow of what you're listening to. So sometimes you can get a score and be quite disappointed with it. But other times, like you say, it just immediately takes you back to the film that you're watching. And one I got recently was It Follows. I don't know if any of you have seen the film It Follows, which is basically a horror film about a presence that's killing people, and the only way to stop it following you is to have sex with somebody, and then it follows them, so it's passed on through sexual contact. So and it's basically a teen horror.
Sexually transmitted phenomenon.
Yeah, it's an STD, sexually transmitted demon. But it's an absolutely brilliant film, and it it's far too easy to give that as a description and people to go away thinking it's your typical teen horror film. It's not. It's an absolutely fantastic film. And the soundtrack is by Disasterpiece, who is the guy who also did the soundtrack to the video game Fez. I bought that soundtrack and I was listening to it, and I think that without that soundtrack, that film could not have been as good as it was. That exact emotions that you're when you're watching that film. And I watched it having been told by every single review, don't watch it alone, don't watch it in the dark, it will mess you up. No matter how prepared you are, it will mess you up. And I watched it telling myself that over and over again, and it messed me up at the end of it. And I listened to the soundtrack and started to feel exactly the same. So I would absolutely recommend you watch that film. Mm-hmm. And when you do, just pay a little bit of attention to the score, because it's a fantastic one. So I definitely recommend it. And it's obviously not going to be one I'm going to suggest as a future show, but I think Aliens is a good choice. Anybody, any of you two guys got anything to say about particular scores that you're fans of?
I do like the Aliens one. Most significant thing about the Aliens soundtrack is that the kind of crescendo of like the end of the movie where it's all building up and there's this kind of like intensity, and that music's been used a lot, I think, whether it's Aliens music or it's a rip-off of it in a lot of trailers to kind of build up a lot of intensity and tension and excitement.
Quite often when they do trailers to music, they haven't got the score done, so they just stick in random music, and that works, obviously.
Simon, movie scores.
I think the normal stuff, mate. That John Williams obviously does a lot of the main movie themes. I think he does them really well, and they really suit the films that he does them in.
Yeah,
there's a similar sort of style throughout the ones he does. They're very iconic.
I think that goes back to the point that Graham was making about somebody basically plagiarising themselves in multiple films, and I think John Williams is probably the worst at that.
The world will be a sorrier place when John Williams is not there to make the music for films, in my opinion. They might not be the best film,
but everything's
got a theme, and that theme becomes the film, and the film becomes a theme. They're synonymous with one another. Yeah, absolutely.
I think John Williams was... He was one of the guys that first kind of pushed the music a bit further as well, because if you think of films like Raiders of the Lost Ark and Star Wars, obviously their theme tunes are iconic, but if you listen to the soundtracks, if you have the music in its entirety, would be almost the length of the movie.
Yeah,
yeah.
You know, every scene has the music on it. Whereas this, obviously we're talking about Aliens, I'm looking at the track listing for the original track listing and also the deluxe special edition, but there's like huge swathes of the movie that have no music in them. And a lot of most movies are like that, whereas John Williams, his movies generally, I mean, every scene in Raiders of the Lost Ark has got iconic theme music in it. Even the bit where the American guys are explaining, the CIA, whoever it is, are explaining to Indiana Jones that he has to go and retrieve the Ark, which is quite a serious and quiet moment. In the background, you've got the spooky John Williams theme playing, you know? So,
you haven't watched the Star Wars trailer, have you? The full trailer.
The first one.
But what you need to do is find the Star Wars trailer, the new one, just find the score from it. There's a version of it with no dialogue at all, just the score. And it'll make you well up.
On, I believe it's Star Wars Episode 1, which most people completely diss, but I still think it's a really good film. Duel of the Fates is an absolute masterpiece. It's a brilliant track. And he doesn't... that's something that I don't think I've heard in others. And if he can pull out another masterpiece like that for the new Star Wars film, I'll be absolutely over the moon, because I do think he's got it in him to make some brilliant, brilliant scores. I just think he's a little bit too derivative sometimes. Okay, so before the credits roll, let's round off by everybody giving their favourite Bond film of all time, Gripper.
Controversial choice, but I love it and I don't care, because I know a lot of people don't like it because it's so cheesy and honestly it is a bit crap, but I'm going for Diamonds Are Forever.
Boggy.
That's a hard choice, but I'm going to have to... The Living Daylights I really like. I liked the action in them, so...
Interesting.
A more believable Bond for the first time in a while after Roger Moore, so that's fine, but that's what I like.
Matt?
Spy Who Loved Me, it's just a classic. It's got everything that a Bond film should have.
Okay, and I'm going to go for the ultra cheesy Octopussy. Okay, so all that leaves is for us all to say goodbye, and for Matthew, who's going to host our next show, to tell us what's coming up.
Okay, well, the next show, I'm sure anyone listening who likes movies knows there's a film coming out fairly soon that we've all been waiting for a long time. So before that film comes out, we're going to talk about the highs and lows of the Star Wars saga up to that point.
Cool. That's it. That's a wrap.